Well, Jack, to continue where we left off last time, you were citing a number of significant examples of where important ethical decisions had to be made, and you were coming close to the subject that's on the mind of so many people and in the press these days, the question of abortion. I suppose one of the fundamental questions is, how do you decide? You talked about when life ends. Now going to the other end, how can you determine when life begins so that the right, that's probably the thing to say, the right ethical decision can be made with respect to abortion?
The question, when does life begin, is inappropriate, but is the question that is usually asked.
Yes.
That is, these cells before conception are alive. You don't get life from death or life from non-life. So that they're simply passing on life at the cellular level that is a part of the genetic inheritance of human beings and all living forms, for that matter. And answering that question, over the years, as people have approached it, a variety of solutions to the question have been provided. And usually this has to do with what we call our first evening, the somatic reduction. Mm-hmm. That is, when in the period of the maturation of these cells does it give us certain responsibilities that we didn't have before that make it now wrong for us to destroy this living form? And there are several stages that in the process of the development of this first embryo and then fetus that have been at one time or another, in one place or another, been suggested as the time when this humanness occurs. I once heard an obstetrician who'd been around for quite a while make the observation that the commonest tumor in the female uterus is a pregnancy. Now, he's quite correct, actually, as far as definitions are concerned, because a tumor is a swelling, mm-hmm. and pregnancy does involve a certain amount of enlargement of tissues. So he's quite correct, but it also suggested a kind of calloused attitude toward this particular organic form that suggests we're dealing with the tissue issue mm-hmm. rather than with the human issue. Mm-hmm. If you can reduce a fetus to a tumor status, then of course you can treat it as though it is merely tissue. Mm-hmm. And this same physician made the observation that since this is the case, mm-hmm. since this is the commonest tumor in the female uterus and has no more significance than tumor significance, that there really is irrelevant to ask the question about whether or not this is a moral issue. It isn't. It becomes a medical issue.
Have you used that catchy phrase, a tissue issue, in public places?
It just occurred to me now.
Well, that's worth remembering. I like that. Sums it up.
Be all right, I said it. But the question of the value then of this, if it has tumor value, then it may also have a tumor disvalue and may therefore be eliminated because it's unwanted for one reason or another. But that it's not a moral issue, it's simply a medical issue. Is it safe to do it? Is it the right period in the development of the fetus so that you don't endanger the mother too much in doing it? And, of course, early abortions are, in proper hands and with proper instruments, relatively safe procedures.
Some could even think of it as a malignant one.
You could talk about a psychically malignant
yes.
tumor
yeah.
that one may wish to eliminate because of its threat to the health, mental health of yeah. the mother. Well, the various stages that are involved in this, and the physician's response that it's merely a medical issue sort of lights this up, because the same physician would not say 9 months later that this is tumor and the mother can do with this newborn what she wishes. We have all kinds of rules and regulations protecting child abuse by parents who threaten their children for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. And a mother who would threaten to destroy her newborn mm-hmm. would be someone who has very serious criminal intent. So something happens, you see, between the time this tumor mm-hmm. is first diagnosed and when it is born, and now no longer is a tumor. Something funny happens on the way to the farm. Mm-hmm. So that you move now from tissue to human. And when is it that that happens? That's the question. And they usually ask in the form, when does life begin? Mm-hmm. The earliest stage of this, of course, is at the moment of conception. And on the basis of our theological presuppositions we were looking at the other night, mm-hmm. that is, the notion of an implanting or infusion of a soul into a body, through most of Christian history, I mentioned to you that they simply followed Aristotle, and it was decided that a male fetus received his soul at 40 days, and the female fetus received her soul at 80 days. And we talked about a bit of male chauvinism involved in this.
How long was that?
Until really the modern period, clear down to the 1700s someplace. And then there were a sufficient number of theologians who said that's fairly artificial, and the difference between the two, one being 40 and the other an 80, mm-hmm. Seemed to be a little strange. And so they began to suggest that maybe it was the moment of conception. And as soon as you get enough theologians to start saying this, then according to a theory called probabilistic, it becomes possible to make an adjustment and say, since there are a significant number of people think that this happens at the moment of conception, mm-hmm. then we have to give some kind of recognition of this. And eventually it shifted over. And the moment of conception, as was the time when this finally became mm-hmm. decided, was the moment when it all happened. So that's the earliest time. There are some other later times which have, from one situation or another, been suggested as the moment when humanness begins. Old English law, for example, mm-hmm. for a long time considered the moment of humanness to be coterminous with the moment of quickening. Mm-hmm. The baby announced itself to the outside mm-hmm. world. Then you had to treat it as though it's human. Mm-hmm. And that also was followed in colonial America, which took a number of things over from England, so that abortions to be performed had to be done before quickening. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it wasn't possible to know you were pregnant until the quickening occurred in some women. But that became the earliest stage after the moment of conception.
And that could vary over quite a period of time?
Significantly, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, usually around 4th month someplace mm-hmm. that happens. There was an earlier period that was sometimes also suggested. That is when the embryo becomes a fetus. Now that's a kind of a technical distinction that is, you know, not really easy for a layman to make mm-hmm. a decision about, but it's observable once you have aborted the fetus or embryo. You can tell whether it was an embryo or a fetus, mm-hmm. and now of course with ultrasound we can pick up that up too. But an embryo, by definition, becoming a fetus at the point where all the organs have now become present. Mm-hmm. And so what happens thereafter is not the developing of new organs, but the enlargement and growth of what is present. Mm-hmm. Fingers and toes are all present, the organs inside the body and so on. And that has traditionally been the moment when you shifted from embryo mm-hmm. to fetus. And that's sometimes set up as the time. Now you have a fully organized little creature and mm-hmm. it looks human from here on, mm-hmm. whereas in those early stages of embryonic life, a sort of strange little forerunner of humanness that's difficult to give human meaning to. The next stage is one that has legal status in quite a mm-hmm. number of the United States, and in fact most of them now have this. This is known as the point of viability. Mm-hmm. When this growing organism, this fetus now, is mature enough that it could survive outside of its mother, independent of its mother, mm-hmm. then you have to treat it as though it is a separate individual who has its own rights and must be treated with the respect that reflects. Mm-hmm. And to kill a fetus after it is viable can be a crime with serious consequences. Now that depends upon a bit of judgment, because it isn't always easy to determine when viability is mm-hmm. concerned. And the recent Supreme Court decision, by the way, took this into account, mm-hmm. that the post-viability fetus had to be given respect. Some years ago when I was consultant to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in their bioethics committee, we were asked to sign an amicus curiae, a friend of the court mm-hmm. document. There was a man by the name of Edelin in Boston who had sort of contracted to do an abortion on a patient and used one of the newer techniques, instilling into the amniotic fluid some hypertonic saline solution that then stimulated the uterus to empty its contents. It's supposed mm-hmm. to, but it didn't work. Mm-hmm. But in the process of instilling that saline solution, it of course killed the fetus. Mm-hmm. Would presumably have killed the fetus, it usually does. But she didn't deliver. So here she is now, supposed to have had an abortion, but it hasn't been successful. So its only recourse now is to open the uterus and remove mm-hmm. it, doing a kind of very early C-section, or an embryotomy. And as he did this, apparently from observers in the operating room, he left his hand inside of the surgical opening for an extraordinary long period of time. And then he took it out and placed the dead fetus on the Mayo stand nearby. Well, a little while later, some investigators were looking into this hospital, and they were looking through various things trying to follow up on another case. And here they found this fairly good-sized baby, dead baby, in the morgue. There was no death certificate for it, mm-hmm. and they were quite perplexed, and so they began to investigate and discovered that this was the fetus that had been delivered. And by size, it must already have been viable. And so the charge was that he kept his hand in there mm-hmm. and squeezed off the cord and killed the baby before he delivered it, because it was bigger than he had expected. Mm-hmm. It was, in fact, viable. And what he should have done legally is to protect that premature fetus mm-hmm. and try to get it going and present the mother with a live baby, a very premature baby, but a live one mm-hmm. that sort of wasn't what she was expecting or what she had contracted for. Well, he was convicted of this crime and appealed it, and we were asked to respond to that appeal by seconding the fact that he did the right medical thing. Mm-hmm. Well, the committee mm-hmm. absolutely refused. Mm-hmm. They said, nothing doing. As soon as we have a viable fetus, that physician has two patients, mm-hmm. the mother and the fetus, and that he has committed a crime, so they refused to sign for him. And he got off on some kind of a legal technicality, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. It was never really resolved. We had a similar case in Southern California, where a physician did exactly the same thing, but discovering it was alive, he simply took it out and it wasn't breathing yet, and so he laid it over on a Mayo stand, mm-hmm. Unattended, hoping that it wouldn't breathe while he went to take care of the mother. Mm-hmm. And about 15 to 20 minutes later, the baby started breathing. But 15 to 20 minutes deprived of oxygen damaged the brain, of course, mm-hmm. of the fetus, it would. And so realizing that what had happened, he went over and strangled it, made it quit breathing. And again was hailed into court, but again got off on a legal technicality of some sort. But this is considered to be criminal. So the age of viability, you see, is the time when maturation is sufficient so that it has an independent existence. Prior to that, it has a dependent existence, and people who say this is the mark of humanness, independence along with the other factors that give it humanness. And as long as it's dependent upon the mother, it can be considered as a part of her body, and therefore it can be treated as something that you want to get rid of, that her body doesn't want or she doesn't want. So that the age of viability is fairly crucial.
Now here you have the law getting into ethics.
That's right, and the law is in this, and most states have rules that say, for example, California has a 24-week shut-off period. If the baby is over 24 weeks old, why, then you assume legally mm-hmm. that it's viable mm-hmm. and have to treat it as such. Some states have 20 weeks, which is very early, mm-hmm. but 24 weeks is getting pretty close to the place where we can now keep it going with all kinds of intensive care efforts. So it's probably the 20-week one is going to be pretty close to what will be generally agreed upon.
In the other model, though, where you've got an immortal soul or spirit there earlier, does the law trespass in that area?
The law really doesn't decide that kind of an issue. Interestingly, the church that holds that position is faced with an interesting problem. That is, with the belief that an infant that is not baptized goes to limbo, mm-hmm. one is required to do something to prevent that kind of end result. I used to have staff privileges in a Catholic hospital, and as a Protestant, and along with the other Protestants as well, we were instructed how to baptize mm-hmm. a fetus that could not be born alive mm-hmm. before it died, so that it would have a chance to go to heaven. So that immortal soul could, in some contexts, go to a place that's less than heaven, mm-hmm. and you might want to avoid that.
Now, some little ethics there. As a physician who would not subscribe to that view, but in your concern that you were talking about yesterday, for the parents, you treating them too, you would go ahead.
But treat them at the level of their perception. You take people where they are and work from that. Mm-hmm. The age of viability is crucial. But there's another age mm-hmm. which has a much older status behind it. A number of the rabbis held the position mm-hmm. that a fetus becomes human at the moment when more than half of the baby is out. They didn't specify whether...
More than half. Doesn't matter which end.
No, they didn't specify whether it made any difference whether it came head first or feet first or whatever. When more than half the baby was delivered, then you now had to treat it as fully human. That didn't mean that they considered the fetus not to be of value, mm-hmm. but it didn't have the same kind of human value it had at the moment of birth. Now, a surprising number of non-Jewish physicians intuitively, without thinking about it, hold a position that's very much like that. In fact, I once heard a good Protestant obstetrician make the observation that there's even a biblical text for this. God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. So you're going to have at least the baby starting to breathe as the time when you're talking about humanness.
That assumes coming head first.
Yeah, that assumes...
That'd be rough. My youngest granddaughter came feet first.
Have a hard time breathing if that happens. That position is also sometimes held.
Would they try to argue that in court ever?
Oh, no. You start pushing and they say, oh, of course, I don't believe it's just the time of delivery. Yeah. But I had a chief when I was a medical intern who had a patient whose fetus was a hydrocephalic, that is, with a huge head with the vertebrospinal fluid putting pressure on the central nervous system. And the head was so big that he couldn't deliver it in the normal way, so he had to do a cesarean delivery on her. He did this, and it was his custom, as is the custom of a number of physicians, to solve things by neglect. That is, if a baby is grossly deformed, there are physicians who will say, look, I won't do anything to get it started, I'll let God take care of it. So you lay it over on a stand and just don't touch it, and, and hope that it won't breathe, and so the problem goes away by itself. And some physicians do that, which is a kind of a way of escaping having to make responsible decisions about it. Well, anyway, this was his custom. So he laid the baby naked, without any care or anything, or blankets or anything, on a barrel of stainless steel mail stand, and then went back looking after the mother. And he got her sewed up and went back to look after the baby, and the baby's gone. And he said, what happened to the baby? And lo and behold, in this nursing school that was connected with this institution, there were some young ladies who had strong maternal instincts who just could not stand to see this baby lying there naked, even if it had a big head, lying there on this mail stand. And they had taken it up to the nursery, and it was an incubator, and it was going very well indeed. Which meant now he had a grossly deformed baby that he's going to have to look after until it died in a couple of years. Already there was so much damage to the central nervous system that there was no recovery.
Did he dare have a word with the nurses?
He was very angry. You see, before the baby breathed, he could neglect it. Once the baby breathed, now it's his patient. Suggesting that that transition from tumor to human takes place when respiration begins.
That's quite widely held?
No, it's not widely held. Well, if we use now our definition of humanness that I gave you the first night, and this might be an occasion to go back and take a look at that, where I define human in terms of a self being an individual who has consciousness, has intellection, able to think, it may be self-conscious, it's not only aware, it is aware that it is aware, it has the capacity for reason, for choice, for making decisions, for being held responsible, for interacting with other selves. See, this is what we mean by yourself. Myself is this individual who has this kind of an awareness. And if we define a human being in terms of that selfhood, which gets close, I think, to the image of God in one, and it is the position that I hold as definition of human. If the image of God has to do with those kinds of qualities, then these are the kinds of qualities that make us like God, and not just a general physical appearance that identifies us with God, but these functions that make it possible for us to carry on social interaction, to love and be responsible, and to know what's going on, and to think, and so on. Now, suppose we take that.
Yeah, where does that begin?
Yeah, where does that happen? You see, because obviously during interuterine life, none of those things happen. You don't have a self functionally until even several years after delivery. You're talking about the age of accountability. And when is the age of accountability?
It's later.
And, legally, there are ages provided for this, whether you know it or not. And it's not bar mitzvah age either. It's an age in English law having to do with human experimentation. There are requirements that say regarding children who are subjects of the investigation that a child that's over 7 years of age can refuse to be a part of the experiment and his parents can't make him do it.
As early as seven.
If a seven-year-old child wants to say, look, I want none of those shots or anything else that's involved in this experimental procedure, he can say it and nobody can make him do it, and it's protected by law, suggesting that seven is an age of accountability.
Now, the age 12 is often used. Is that in connection with bar mitzvah?
That's kind of age 12, 13.
Yes, I see. But seven?
It's 7 years. And America has a similar kind of guidance in the guidelines that are provided by NIH.
You mean the colonies have not rejected that?
No. But that's a kind of an age of accountability. But
seven.
But look what this would imply. If we said this is not human until it's seven.
Seven.
Or even if we want to be a bit less wild than that and suggest that maybe even earlier than that you'd have to give some human meaning to this child, Piaget in his book on the moral development of a child suggests by the time a child is 2 or 3 years of age, already it's beginning to develop its moral sense, conscience, relationship to parental interactions and so on. Suppose we said 3 years of age, and it becomes human at three. Look what you could do during those first 3 years. If you didn't like its sex, you could take it out and expose it and kill it, reject it, and do it quite innocently. Because killing, in this case, infanticide, would be no more criminal than would be feticide, which is the abortion. And if you can do one, you can do the other, because it isn't human yet.
How old can the child be and come under the name infanticide?
From infancy to on up into childhood. So I would guess probably the first 5 years.
For 5 years it could be infanticide.
Certainly child abuse in the latter part of it. But, well, which means, in retrospect, that using the somatic reduction as the definition of humanness simply doesn't work, because the facts of the case are none of those stages are precise enough. For example, viability depends upon whether or not you're within reach of neonatal intensive care service, or whether you're in Appalachia someplace where you have no care at all. The child in Appalachia has to be pretty mature before it's going to survive, but over here we can take them pretty young now, so there's a variation of 2 or 3 months even there almost, at least a couple of months difference. And the more effective we become in dealing with neonates, the more likely we are to produce that one interesting day down the road when we shall be able to carry babies to term in an artificial uterus. Aldous Huxley once wrote a book entitled A Brave New World, in which in this book he envisioned a time in the future when babies would be born in factories in big bottles. And when delivery time came, you simply went over with a hammer and smashed bottles and delivered babies that way. And they simply avoided the intrauterine environment altogether. Now that's science fiction at this point, but interestingly enough, science fiction often ends up a few years later being science. So with that possibility, then of course the whole notion of viability is overturned. There's one other point that is sometimes also mentioned from a Protestant perspective, particularly a Protestant perspective in which the doctrine of the soul has become holistic, or where the somatic reduction has been complete. That is, where you recognize that even though the cells are together, in order for that, because you don't have any soul to deal with, if you want to have an early definition of humanness, you define it in terms of its potential. That is, it's not in terms of what it now is, but what it can become. At the moment of conception, gets those chromosomes together, and you get your complete component of chromosomes, with the possibility then of maturation and development, and the baby's code is laid down, you see, right there at the very start, when those two cells unite. So that one, there's certain logic in saying that one's potential begins there. But with some of our newer experimental work, we can produce this conception in a petri dish or a test tube outside of the uterine environment. But there's no possibility, no potential for a fertilized ovum lying in a little petri dish to become a baby without being put in the appropriate environment. So those who would like to say that actually you have to include not only the two cells together, but you've got to include the appropriate nurturing environment that will make it possible for this to happen, which means uterine implantation. And conception takes place in a fallopian tube, which is outside of the uterus, and it takes several days for the fertilized ovum to go down and lodge inside the uterine cavity. Well, what you do with certain contraceptive devices is to prevent that implantation. And this has made an interesting kind of problem when you relate to intrauterine devices as contraceptive devices, which, by the way, were developed centuries ago in the Middle East, where camel drivers discovered that they could prevent their camels from becoming pregnant on caravan by taking small stones and insert these up into the camel's uterus, and she wouldn't get pregnant as long as that small stone was there. Now we make them out of plastic materials, and the intrauterine device is the outset of that. But what we think happens is that somehow we prevent the implantation of that fertilized ovum. And people who believe the soul is implanted in that fertilized ovum
is already there.
Conception, then these kinds of contraception are actually abortifacient, that produce abortions. And so do some of this new hormone that has been developed in Europe, which has so far been excluded from America, in which women can take this kind of pill and produce a very early abortion. And that, if you hold that the soul is implanted at the moment of conception, then you have to also reject that as an unwarranted abortion. Well, what does a Christian have to say about this who takes a holistic understanding of man and has a great respect and reverence for the creator of life. There are three bases for my valuing this fetus. Sometimes the discussion is built around the notion of how much is a fetus worth. Mm-hmm. There are three things that give the fetus worth, as far as I'm concerned, and more than just tumor worth or tissue worth. They give it human value, and one of these is my general respect for life.
You're saying fetus here, by the way.
I should be saying embryo.
Would you?
Yes.
Okay.
But this would also carry the fetus,
yes,
because the
yeah,
embryo and fetus is still
but
part of the continuum.
You go early enough that you could use the term embryo, then?
I go even early enough to include the pre-embryo.
Okay.
That life is sacred. And my respect for the creator of life leads me to have respect and reverence for his creation and preservation of human life, mm-hmm, even if it is very, very immature human life, mm-hmm, is a part of my respect and reverence for God. I think that's certainly a permissible kind of notion for a Christian to hold, and mm-hmm, I've always been impressed by Albert Schweitzer's reverence for life, mm-hmm, in which he even says things like, sometimes we have to sacrifice life to preserve larger life, but it's never right to take life. Mm-hmm. Even the farmer who turns his cows loose in the pasture, and these cows eat the grass and the flowers, as a part of sustaining their lives, because they are higher forms of life, this must be done, it is mm-hmm legitimate. But the farmer who does that, as he walks home, should not carelessly, just as a way of passing the time, pluck the head off the flower just as a careless kind of an mm-hmm act. He must have the same kind of respect for all of life. This is just Schweitzer's position. Mm-hmm. It sometimes seems a little bit extreme, but still there's a point to be made in this. I think it's a part of one's reverence for God.
And he also was a musician. He was autistic.
Sure. So he artistic, not autistic.
Yes.
There's a certain kind of, reality in what he's describing. That is a valid expression mm-hmm of a worshiping of the Creator. And mm-hmm as a Christian, mm-hmm, that's one of my basic presuppositions, that God is the Creator. Mm-hmm. And since I worship and love God, I must also look after his creation. So that's one source of my valuing. Another source of my valuing is what, in fact, this conceptus can become. These two cells that now united their cellular mm-hmm genetic structures together now can become something marvelous.
The potential again?
Oh, yes, the potential is a part of my valuing of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of this every time I think of the young student that I had on campus some years ago. She came to see me in consultation. Her husband was a student at that time. And they were having a hard time financially, and she had to work to help put him mm-hmm through, and she became pregnant. And he says, you can't do that. I mean, if you become pregnant and have a baby, you're going to rob me of my career. I'll have to quit going to school. He says, you got to have an abortion. She says, I don't want to have an abortion. Well, you got to have one. There's just no way around it. We're ruined if you don't have an abortion. Well, he made arrangements and mm-hmm had the appointment all set up for her. And she came to see me the day before the arrangements mm-hmm were to be carried out. And she told me all about it and said, but I don't want this abortion. But since my husband, I guess, is the head of the home and it means so much to him, I guess I'd better have it. Well, now, as a counselor, I've always adopted the position that people have to make up their own minds about things. Mm-hmm. And my role as a counselor to help them is to help them discover what all the angles are and what the problems are so that they make an informed mm-hmm decision. That's what I usually do. But in this case, I violated my usual practice. Mm-hmm. I felt she needed some help here, and so I told her, I said, if I were pregnant and my husband said I should have an abortion and I didn't want to have an abortion, I wouldn't get an abortion. What my husband said, I wouldn't get an abortion. I'd have my right to preserve what I valued, and I wouldn't get it. Mm-hmm. She said, thank you, and left. Mm-hmm. I didn't see her again for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. I was walking across the parking lot over here in the evening, and I heard through the dusk a voice calling out, Dr. Pavanchi, she said, and I stopped to see who it was. And here was this lady coming, and she had in her arms a little boy. And she came to me and she says, Doctor, here he is. And then she told me mm-hmm that she'd gone home and told her husband she wasn't going to have an abortion. And now, a year and a half later, her husband didn't have to drop out of school either. They mm-hmm made other arrangements. Mm-hmm. And here was this lovely baby, little baby boy. Too pretty for a boy. And I held out my finger to him, and he reached up and he grasped my finger like this, and he smiled, the biggest smile. Mm-hmm. It wasn't gas.
Maybe he knew something.
It wasn't gas, either smile. Well, that little fellow, I said, you don't realize how much right you have to give me that big smile.
I wonder about the father. Was he proud of it?
Then she said to me, and his daddy loves it.
Ah, that rounds out the story.
Ah, yes. But it's that kind of thinking about the future.
Yeah.
Who knows what the future... Of course, you might end up being Hitler too, but you can't predict this. But there is this sense of wonder, the miracle of it, the wonder of it, of what this can become. I think that's a part of being a Christian and respecting life.
Mm-hmm.
See? And then there is the other thing that I referred to when I talked about at the end of life, the respect that one must manifest as a way of preserving those sensitivities in oneself. I don't think a person could be engaged in an abortion mill kind of activity without suffering some consequences to his sensitivities. In fact, in the New England Medical Journal a few years ago, there was somebody who had performed some 20,000 abortions in his life, and one day he woke up and looked at himself in the mirror and he said, "What on earth am I doing?" And reacted to his what had become an ordinary routine, and now reacted against this and became an anti-abortion advocate. As a consequence of rediscovering a certain sensitivity. Well, I think we have to protect that. I think that preserving human life in a larger sense depends upon people not seeing pregnancy as some sort of an enemy thing having happened to you. You're not dealing with an adversary when you're dealing with a pregnancy, but something, even though it may be inconvenient, and I don't know of many pregnancies that come at the highest time of convenience, but it may be inconvenient. Still, at the same time, it's a wonder and the miracle of it.
Now, thinking of the third and remembering the beautiful story, the second, what if you met this mother and the baby was seriously disfigured? Yeah. Her husband had had to drop out of school and had divorced her.
I would still have said that in view of the fact that she couldn't know that was what would happen, that she'd still have to play what would be the most likely outcome. And I felt that what the outcome was the most likely one. And you had to make decisions in terms of probabilities, and that was the probability, certainly.
You might have had to work a little harder to explain number three.
That's right.
To her.
Which brings me to my three reasons why I think abortions may be done.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I hold this position, and I'm therefore on the side of fetuses, the side of life.
And you have been ever since I've known you.
But there are times.
Yeah.
When, for example, two lives are in conflict with each other, in which one has to sacrifice one or the other. You know, I had a Catholic mother who, for theological reasons, based upon the notion that the baby that was coming hadn't yet had its chance for eternity, and she had, a mother of six children, by the way, and she was about to deliver, and she said, "Doctor," she said, "if you can't save both of us, you have to save the baby." And I thought, "My, you mean I'll sacrifice this mother of these six children in order to save a baby?" You know, I never had to make the decision, but I thought long and hard about whether, in fact, I'd go along with that.
It's almost like Moses, though. He said, "If you can't save the people, take my life instead."
Well, you know, it sounded very heroic, self-sacrificing on her part. The theological issue was that her baby hadn't had his chance yet to have eternity and to be taught and whatever, whereas she'd had her chance, and she was willing to give her baby the chance. Well, things went okay, see, so we had no problem. And usually by the time you've had six of them, they come pretty easy. But that was one way of looking at it.
Not the usual.
No, not the usual, and it creates some interesting conflicts in my own mind. But sometimes, and this is relatively rare now, all that we can do, having a baby does not usually confront the mother with the risk to her life. Now, it can happen, and it can happen in certain places more easily than other places, but it can happen. And there are certain kinds of conditions, for example, a mother who may have a malignancy and getting pregnant may make that a very serious kind of complication. So it can happen. And I say that's a legitimate situation where you have to decide not life or death, but which life. And on that ground, I would say there's more humanness, selfhood invested in the mother at this stage than there would be in this potential self. And so therefore, if you had to choose between the two, I'd send the mother home to her six children and sacrifice the baby if that sacrifice had to be made. So that's one reason, the life of the mother. But it's more than just the life of the mother, it's the selfhood of the mother that's involved in this. I'm not just talking about life because those are living selves before they become potentially selves. So that the self of the mother is a factor. For example, if a pregnancy is so sufficiently threatening to this mother, it's so horrendous in her point of view, that she is emotionally severely disturbed by this and runs the danger then of losing herself psychiatrically. I say that's also a reason for doing this. But again, as a selection between two selves in conflict, and one a potential self and the other an actual self, I sacrifice the potential one in order to preserve.
Is that one much harder to measure?
That's a more difficult one to measure because, of course, people who want abortions can manufacture all kinds of reasons why their health is being threatened, including their mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not easy, and sometimes consultation is useful, and observing over a period of time is useful.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another reason that I can see as a legitimate one. But then there are a couple of others. One of these, both of these are kind of permissive reasons rather than strong indications. And one of these is a woman who is raped, becomes pregnant during rape, and has imposed upon her, with no choice of her own, a pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm saying the jeopardy that that places her in psychiatrically is, again, a sufficient reason, if she wants to abort that fetus, to do so. And I would say that's a legitimate reason for doing it. The trauma, the psychological trauma, the pressure of the way in which the child became conceived is a big enough burden by itself, without adding to this a constant reminder of what happened. And to look after a baby that you had conceived as a result of that horrendous experience, you know, that's asking too much, I think, of a mother. So that I'd grant abortion for a way of dealing with pregnancy relating to rape. I would suggest that probably one could save some of the more sensitivity-damaging factors if one were to use one of these early aborting or abortifacient agents that can produce abortion the morning after, rather than waiting for several months before you did the surgical procedure.
Sooner the better.
Yeah, sooner the better. And then the other one is even less, although I knew a woman once who was pregnant from rape, who said, look, there's no reason why I should punish this child for its father's sins. And so she raised the child as her own and loved it, and made that adjustment to it.
Did that say something about her?
It says something about her, but it's certainly something you wouldn't ask many people to do as a kind of a norm.
Yeah.
And then there's the third one, the third reason, that is partly tied into both of these previous ones given. I guess really four reasons, come to think of it. The third one has to do with pregnancy from incest, in which the social implications of that and the stress that's involved in this could be a reason, not an absolute reason, but a permissible reason for performing an abortion. Because it is the case that not many cases of a fetal abnormality result from consanguinity, that is close blood types interacting. So I think that I would grant this, however, as a legitimate time. Then the fourth one, which is also partly controversial, is based upon the notion, our awareness, that most abortions are performed by the body itself. We talked about this a little earlier. That is, the body gets rid of defective conceptuses and does so as a kind of a house cleaning operation. And in the practice of medicine, many of our activities as physicians have to do with helping the body do what the body was designed to do, but for some reason or other doesn't do it. And a woman who should have aborted, and I talked to you about the baby that was born without a head, my first delivery, that was sufficient reason for performing an abortion. And if I had known that that baby was that defective during early pregnancy, I would have aborted it without any qualms of conscience, because it never can be a self. And therefore, the problem doesn't exist. All one has to do is do this with a certain amount of dignity so that one protects one's sensitivities about even doing this very right thing. So I'd say a baby that is born with grossly deformed, particularly central nervous system tissues, so that you have the lack of a potential for achieving humanhood, I'd say that early diagnosis of that surely is the way to go, and surely this is a time when one can almost talk about an absolute indication for abortion, depending how severe the deformity is. One does not abort for every deformity, and one can run into situations where your deformities are certainly discovered on the basis of percentages. That is, getting rubella early in pregnancy can have a certain percentage of defects, but what do you do in the terms of the percentages? Suppose you have a situation in which statistics have told us that 20% of babies will be defective if the mother has had whatever kind of insult, radiation or something else at an early period. 20%, you will sacrifice 80% of normal fetuses in order to get at those 20%. I say that in those circumstances, if it cannot be determined that there's an actual defect, you have to play the percentages in a sense. I say you wait and see what you've got. make your decision on the basis and pick up the pieces at the end, rather than deciding to sacrifice normal fetuses for the sake of a certain percentage.
Now, in all of this, you're speaking from the holistic approach.
I'm talking about a holistic approach.
Which some of the pro-life opponents to abortion, would they believe that the anencephalic baby has a soul?
That's right. And so I'm expressing my point of view, which is the holistic position. And I think that is a Christian position, because it is based more upon a biblical frame of reference about the nature of man than is the immortal soul notion. But you're quite correct. This would not be a position which would be highly regarded. And I have been picketed for giving lectures on abortion that included this kind of frame of reference.
But the issue was theological.
Yes. But I tried to reason, but this is why I said the other night, I think that often there are hidden agendas behind these kind of people that make it kind of irrational. And there's no point. It's a waste of effort to try to give rational answers to irrational questions.
Well, to what extent, if the fetus is thoroughly disfigured, how disfigured?
That's the question, isn't it? That's why I said an anencephalic is not a question.
No, but make it less than that.
If you're less than this, I wouldn't think that a missing arm or missing leg or even missing forearms, or two arms and two legs, would be necessarily a reason for doing this. If you have a defect that is going to interfere with the selfhood so that there is no potential for genuine selfhood developing, that's legitimate reason. But since it is the case that diminished selfhood is a relative expression, one has to make some decisions. And I know of no way to get around the wrestling over that issue. But at least wrestling with some kind of guidelines or guideposts is likely to be more rational wrestling than simply facing it without any kind of guiding principles to guide one. So I don't know any way around that one. But I can say in a general sense, if it can be a self, and that self is going to have the major qualities of selfhood that allow it, for example, to be a responsible person from God's standpoint. You're dealing here with life that has interesting implications for the future, eternity and so on, is involved in this on the basis of Christian belief. And under those circumstances, it seems to me that if one can say that this baby is so grossly deformed, it never is accountable and never will be a part of what has to do with the hereafter, then we consign it along with those other kinds of embryo losses that spontaneous abortion reflects. If, on the other hand, there is reason to believe that at least sufficient selfhood is likely to result to make this worth preserving, then I think you're required to do it. And this is why the condition that we know as trisomy 21, or Mongolism, or Down syndrome, why this is a peculiar problem. Because some of those fetuses have sufficient selfhood to actually function as being responsible selves. Some do not, but you can't always know it. And the time you know it, when it's already too late to make the decision, it's after they're a few months or years old, before you discover how much intelligence is present. So I think that's a special case, and I don't like to use it as a way of defining the issue, because it is a special case.
How's a decision made in a case like that? And the doctors today are being extra careful, because...
As a matter of fact, in all of these decisions, I am not the one who decides that the mother shall or shall not perform the abortion. I have to decide whether or not I will perform it. And most laws permit physicians to and nurses as well not to become involved in decisions that they consider to be immoral. So that I wouldn't perhaps do it. My responsibility is seeing to it that the person who is contemplating an abortion is informed. So she knows what the issues are. If she decides to do it after having been informed, then it's her responsibility. And I may avoid participating in it because of my own moral sense. But I happen to be pro-choice, you see. I think that doctors shouldn't make choices for patients.
In making this, taking this approach, the secular ethicist would be more likely to agree with you than another Christian ethicist.
That's correct.
Would that be right?
That's an odd dilemma.
That's
probably correct. But I think that the secular ethicist on this in this case is on the side of right. That is because self-determination, the capacity for free will and for choice, is a basic element of being a self, being a human being. And that has to be honored in the sense of allowing that individual, as God does. You see, you can take this guidance from God himself, who allows us to decide to destroy ourselves by rebelling against him. Now, he does everything he can to be sure that that is an informed decision. Mm-hmm. And he uses all the effort that he can bring to bear to talk us out of it. Mm-hmm. But if we persist and decide to destroy ourselves, God throws up his hands and said, Ephraim is joined to idols, let him alone. See? So that on that basis, as a Christian, I have to say that dealing with patience, something like that has to prevail. And mm-hmm. so I never make decisions for patience at that level, but I am very responsible for helping them to think through some of the implications. And on that basis then, as I say, I'm pro-choice, mm-hmm. while I'm also pro-life, which makes me kind of something put together by a committee these days.
Now, how can the Supreme Court make a decision in this area? We talk about separation of church and state, and but now we have not only religion but politics getting involved in this at the present time.
We make laws, and I think quite rightly, that protect newborns, don't we? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's against the law to abuse a child. Mm-hmm. If you kill a child, that it can be a serious crime. See? Mm-hmm. So that we make those kinds of protections already. And it seems to me that it is permissible to make certain kind of protective laws for this defenseless fetus, mm-hmm. unless it is threatening its certain values in its mother, see? Mm-hmm. Defenseless fetus that was just simply born at the wrong time, the mm-hmm. wrong place, and is inconvenient. Protect this person. So that, in other words, it's part of all of our responsibility to protect the defenseless ones among us. And I'm defining this potential self that is developing along the way as a defenseless self, potential self. And therefore, except in those situations where you have to decide between selves, I say that the law is perfectly right in protecting mm-hmm. that innocent individual. And on that basis, the law could, I think, quite morally mm-hmm. Move in to give the kind of protection to defenseless people that we provide for defenseless children.
Now, when does the fetus, when does the embryo begin to have constitutional rights?
I say, from my perspective, with my reverence for life, I'm saying that as soon as it has potential for selfhood, mm-hmm. it draws on that potential as having certain rights that have to be protected. Now that right becomes more easy to define at the time of viability, mm. see, because now it does have independent existence. But I'm saying it is perfectly legitimate to begin that at the moment of implantation, mm-hmm. because I think that you don't have the potential till you have the two cells together in the right place. Mm-hmm. Those three frozen embryos in Australia to which I referred the mm-hmm. other night have no potential for humans as long as they're in that freezer. Mm-hmm. They have to be placed in the uterus. And then at that point you start talking about potential for personhood, for selfhood.
Well, to what extent do you think the present conflict, which has serious political implications, may cost many a man his seat?
Well, I think it's very likely, unless they're politically shrewd,
yes.
and learn how to, you know, a politician is sometimes defined as somebody that if there were three sides to a fence, it'd be on all three sides of them.
Yes.
It's pretty clever, pretty hard to do.
I'll try to on this issue.
But in this issue, it's going to be very difficult to do.
Yes.
Because they're going to have to be confronted with a decision one way or the other. You're either for it or you're against it. If you're against it, then we won't vote for you, or if you're for it, depending on which side you're supporting.
But now many of the placards that they carry out there, they have texts of Scripture.
Oh, yes.
They talk about sin and so forth.
Yes.
How much is religion, how much is theology involved in this great issue that faces the United States at the present time?
Well, theology is involved at the level of the presuppositions.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the conflict comes at the level of the application. If you adopt certain presuppositions, then you're faced with certain kinds of complications or conclusions that follow that adoption. Unfortunately, the Bible is not really clear on this. Mm-hmm. The only text that seems to be saying with some seriousness mm-hmm. that the fetus has less value than its mother, and that's about as much as you can gain from the text, is that one in Exodus 21 where it talks about if they're striving together and mm-hmm. the woman loses her fetus. Mm-hmm. And no harm comes, but the antecedents to the pronouns there are very difficult to mm-hmm. untangle. Mm-hmm. And we don't know whether we're saying no harm comes to the fetus, in which case it is a premature birth, or does the no harm come to the mother, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's an ambiguous text and cannot be used clearly, even though it is sometimes the attempt that is made. Other references, for example, to John the Baptist leaping in his mother's womb mm-hmm. in the presence of Jesus, and therefore indicating that he had the ability to think and to respond and whatever, that had selfhood already before he's born, is, I think, straining the text a bit, at least straining credulity.
Interestingly enough, there's one translation of the New Testament that even determines whether it's an embryo or a fetus at that time. There was a gentleman in Boston who felt that the King James Version was entirely vulgar in its rendering of this passage. So in true Bostonian English, he translated that verse, "The embryo was joyfully agitated." So he had determined it was an embryo, not a fetus. It was quite early on that there was a quickening.
Yeah, that's an early quickening.
That's an early quickening, isn't it? Well, now, it's been observed that many of these folk who are pro-life, in their conservatism, also favor capital punishment.
Yes.
Will that be pointed out during this political campaign?
The irrationality, if you already tell the rationality of that, yeah, already tells us that these kinds of situations are irrational circumstances in which rational answers are not appropriate or not, mm-hmm, not accepted. So I think there's no way to get around people who oppose war violently.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of a contradiction in that statement. And just so with right to lifers who insist on capital punishment as a consequence for a crime.
Another issue that's going along with this at the same time, especially in the experience of one of the candidates for governor or governess, shall we say, of the state of California. She declares she is pro-life, but her headquarters are in San Francisco, which brings up the question of homosexuality.
Which may very well be the subject of our next discussion.
Good. I think many would be concerned about that. Isn't it amazing that these issues that used to belong in the physician's office, and maybe some theologians thought about them, are headlines in the newspapers now?
That's right.
And articles in the Reader's Digest.
They are everybody's questions.
Everybody's questions at the present time.